أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most gracious, ever merciful Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all Good morning and welcome to another edition of The Breakfast Show It is Wednesday the 27th of March 2024 You are joined here in the Voice of Islam studio by myself, Muhammad Atar and brother Abdul Halim How are you doing this morning, brothers?
Blessings of Allah be upon all of our listeners and on you as well, my co-presenter.
Yes.
Yes, very nice day outside from our window.
It was very cold when I was driving down. The temperature was showing around 5 degrees.
Yeah, yeah, no, as in the temperature is really cold, but when you look outside, the sun's out.
So hopefully it gets a little bit better.
Yeah, it puts you in a good mood, isn't it?
Most definitely, because as you know, time is progressing, we are approaching, you know, the summertime.
Summertime's coming, yeah.
So, yeah, it's something to look forward to.
And in the past few weeks, like, temperatures have been hitting around 15, 16. It's been quite, like, enjoyable during the day, isn't it?
But it feels like as if we haven't had the summer for...
A long time now.
For, like, 2 years?
Yeah, a long time. It's just we've been adjusted. We've just been used to the cold now, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So that's why it feels good when the sun's out. Even now when the sun is just hitting us from the window. We were just talking about having blinds in here.
Yes. How's your Ramadan's going so far?
Ramadan's been an opportunity for all of us, isn't it, to have that connection and relationship with God Almighty, to build it once again.
Definitely.
So it's a good opportunity for us all Muslims to praise and worship even more.
Yes.
And get closer to God.
I'm just paraphrasing here, but you know, His Holiness, the current head of the Ahmadi Muslim community, he said that, you know, there's no point of just doing, you know, the acts of worship or praying unless, you know, you have righteousness present in you. And that is the key.
That is the whole point. Even that in the Holy Quran, the reason why fasting is prescribed to us Muslims is so that we can attain righteousness,
isn't it?
So that's the key. If you do not strive towards righteousness, then all the staying hungry is not the point.
It's to
increase in your righteousness, increase in your spirituality, and get closer to God Almighty who created us.
Of course. As always, we do have an interesting lineup of topics for you guys this morning that we'll be discussing, as well as some interesting guests that we will be interviewing. For the first segment, we'll be discussing how there's a news report of an institute called Social Contribution British Muslim. And for the second segment, we'll be discussing Israeli human rights groups accuse country of failing to abide by ICJ's Gaza and ruling. But before that, let's get into the news and the weather. What is happening, you know, around the world? Or even within our country. One of the headlines from The Guardian reads that public satisfaction with the NHS at its lowest ever level, polls show. Only 24% of people in England, Scotland and Wales content with health services, with long waits to be seen, the commonest complaint. Public satisfaction with the NHS has fallen to the lowest level ever, and it has plummeted by 29% since before COVID-19 emerged in early 2020, and by an enormous 46% from the highest ever 70% recorded in 2010. You know, these figures, one might read these figures and, you know, you might start wondering, you know, what is really going on, but basically, the long wait list, what is happening is there's many long wait lists in regards to when you go to GP, when you go to, for example, the A&E, you're going to have to wait.
The wait time.
Especially the A&E, the wait time is very long. It can be a couple of hours, could be 4 to 6 hours plus. And
especially A&E, I think anyone that goes to A&E at any time, it's not even during the day, during the night, the wait hours are around 4 to 5 hours. So you could go and tell your what issue you have and go home and then come back and still your turn wouldn't be, because one of my relatives just recently had an issue, and he went to the A&E, told him that what issue he had, and they said, okay, you can wait.
Yes.
And he waited for 2 hours, then went back home and came back, and still his turn wasn't had come up yet.
Hmm.
So the waiting hours are, people are concerned about that.
Definitely. So we hope, we hope and pray that, you know, the government does, you know, do right by its people, and may Allah the Almighty guide them on the right path so they can, they can do right by the people and, you know, do right by the nurses and the patients, right?
Yeah.
In other news, there's, you know, Israel has basically accused the US of hurting hostage talks. Netanyahu administration hits out at Washington for refusing to veto UN ceasefire resolution on Gaza.
Yeah. He cancelled his delegation meetings that he was going to have in America because the US did not veto the new UN resolution.
Yeah, they...
Which is quite childish, I would
say. They abstained.
Yeah, they abstained. They Israel wanted them to veto.
Yes.
So that's what Netanyahu was saying.
Mm.
And because they didn't, they said that now the delegation meeting is not going to go ahead. The talking points on the Israel and the Palestine war would not go ahead, as in we won't send our delegation over there.
Yes.
So, to be fair, it would have been a good opportunity for them to go and discuss what can be done to bring peace. But as you can see, Netanyahu did not want that to happen after USA did not veto and did not back them.
Yes.
So it just shows that, you know, everyone, all the other countries are now coming to terms what Israel is doing.
Yes.
So
I just like to, you know, this is the Financial Times, I'd just like to read out a few statements. So Israel's foreign minister has accused the US of undermining hostage negotiations in Gaza, claiming that Washington had made an ethical mistake, in inverted commas, by failing to veto a UN resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the enclave.
Yeah.
And
but you know this resolution?
Yes.
So they called for immediate ceasefire.
Yes.
For the 2 months, they said.
For
Ramadan. 2 weeks. Yeah, for the Ramadan.
Yeah. Yes.
And
Who was it? I believe Russia tried to put the word permanent in there. I was reading something.
No,
like
as
this.
In basically Russia and China,
yes.
They vetoed a resolution that was before this resolution.
Okay.
Because they said that this is not fair on the Palestinians because this just basically shows that the hostages will be given back to them. And there's nothing that's written in the resolution which says that there will be a ceasefire.
Hmm.
So it's just, they've just played around with words. That's why Russia and China vetoed it.
Okay.
But now this new resolution had immediate ceasefire in it.
But only for
the 2 weeks
Ramadan.
For the month of Ramadan. So it's just a pause. Yeah. So afterwards they could still commence.
Exactly.
But even though UN has passed this resolution of immediate ceasefire, the next day Israel, what do they do? They go and airstrike Gaza, Palestine, Rafah, where they are told again and again not to go because it will cause a lot of casualties. So even yesterday, there's a headline saying that Israel pounds Gaza north and south as condemnation of war grows louder. So attacks on Gaza intensify.
Yes, but you know, it is as His Holiness, the current head of the MDM community, Hazrat Mirza Masroor Ahmad, may Allah be his helper, has stated, you know, on a few different occasions that the UN basically doesn't really have any power, right?
Yeah.
From what we're seeing, you know, they're doing all these votes and
there's no one to implement.
Exactly. And he has, you know, alluded to the fact that if, you know, World War III was to come around, which it can lead to, right, all these actions, everything that's happening around the world in Russia, Gaza, Palestine, there won't be, the UN will be basically wiped out, right?
Exactly. Because to put it is like they don't have any teeth.
They
can't really implement what they've decided.
It's just talks.
The UN resolution that just passed, the next day Israel and goes and strikes again, that just shows that they don't have any power.
Exactly.
So, as the League of Nations was destroyed after the war, the same thing could happen here. And His Holiness has said it many times.
In other news, we'll be discussing this further on as well with the ICJ's ruling as well as one of our topics. So we'll move on to other news that there is a headline of The Telegraph which reads, Sadiq Khan is ruining London and the Tories are just letting him. Low energy conservatives are betraying the capital by effectively writing it off as a political lost cause.
Hmm.
I mean, I won't go into the article too much, but just from the headline, you know, we can see that even obviously, as we know, right, many people are coming forward and saying, I mean, for a newspaper to say this, right, he's the mayor of London, and they're saying he's ruining because London. Because there was a supposed, you know, there was like a attack, like an ad of an attack that he put out. And the video was from New York and not even from London. So, like, you know, people are really accusing him of, like, what's going on over there.
Oh.
Like, as if it's a fake, like there's a lie in the campaign video.
Oh, okay.
It was of New York and not of London.
It wasn't
of
London.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
that's a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he's been caught out in that. So, yeah.
In other news, I'm pretty sure all of our listeners are aware of as well. You know, in America, Baltimore, the bridge that collapsed, and sadly, six people lost their lives. I think it was a shipping container, a really big ship, which hit into one of the pillars of the bridge, which made the whole bridge collapse, and some of the construction. As in, there were Mayday calls, which stopped the cars from going onto the bridge.
Yes,
but there were six construction workers who were filling out potholes on the bridge, and the bridge collapsed sadly, and they lost their lives. May God give their family strength and be with them. So that's one of the headlines that's going around the world today.
I mean, you know, I would assume that bridges are, should be more durable, right? But I guess it was built in like around the 1970s.
But still, and if you see the video, it's it looks quite fragile, the way it
the way it just tumbles down, right?
So I was quite surprised that because it just hit into one pillar and the whole bridge just collapsed.
So I think they need to, their government, you know, needs to look into the other bridges as well, right? And make sure to ensure their safety and to maybe, you know, reinforce those bridges. So something like this doesn't happen.
And I was reading that Biden has immediately said that they will be funding for another high-class bridge that they will be making in that area.
Yes.
And hopefully it's much stronger than this one.
Hopefully. Indeed.
Yeah.
Anything else interesting that's caught your eye?
So but one of the news is that UN rights expert accuses Israel of acts of genocide. That's one of the headlines.
Okay.
In BBC News.
Okay.
So Gaza War, it says UN rights expert accuses Israel of acts of genocide.
That's an interesting
thing. Yeah, that's an interesting
for
headline.
For BBC to, you know, put out there as
Yeah, it's actually one of the first times I've read a news which is against, you can say, Israel and in the rights of Palestine.
I mean, if you look at the figures, right, the amount, the death toll.
Yeah. More than 30,000.
Yeah. More than 32,000.
Yeah. Right. And half of that, more than half of that are just children.
Yes. So, even the Pentagon chief, right, has said that the civilian death toll in Gaza is far too high.
Yeah, it's just outrageous how this is still ongoing after the videos that are out on social media, after the numbers that everyone are seeing, and it's still going on. Yeah. Even after the UN part that we just spoke about passed the resolution, and it's still going on. So yeah, but we will talk a bit more about this in our in our segment that's coming up later.
Most definitely. And so for now, I think I believe we are taking a very short break. And then we will be moving on to our first segment of the morning. So don't go anywhere, dear listener, and then do join us after a very short break.
You're listening to the Voice of Islam Radio, broadcasting on DAB and via the internet 24 hours a day.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most gracious, ever merciful. Welcome back to the Breakfast Show, dear listeners. We will now swiftly be moving on to our next topic. topic, the social contribution of British Muslim. A recent study arrived out of Dr. Raqib Ehsan and Dr. Jake Scott showed that Muslims are overwhelmingly family-oriented, hard-working citizens who viewed Britain as a land of opportunity. The survey explored forms of social belongings, attitudes towards family and community, and views on the degree to which Britain offers opportunities for people to fulfill their potential. The survey itself was done to determine the social contribution of British Muslims. Respondents in both the general population and British Muslim surveys were asked whether they engaged in the following civic behaviours over the past 12 months, given a charitable donation, unpaid volunteer work in the local community, provided care to elderly relative, gifted money to a friend with no desire and no expectation of repayment, and shared homemade food with someone who is not a family member. The survey was carried out on both the general population and on the British Muslims in order to compare the two.
Yeah, you know, as you said, that the two individuals that shows that Muslims are overwhelmingly family-oriented. Yes. This is just the teaching of Islam.
Yes.
So as in, we are taught to behave in this kind of way.
Of course.
So that we can please God Almighty. There's a narration of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him. He says that the best among you are those that are best towards their families. So anyone that says that Muslims are very family-oriented,
yes,
that's basically the teachings of Islam. The Holy Prophet has taught us to behave in this way. And hard-working citizens, as you mentioned, that's because we are told that loyalty to one's nation,
yes,
is part of faith, right? So that's why Muslims will try to contribute as much as they can to the society, because it's the teaching of Islam.
Most definitely. I was seeing this clip, right, of this interviewer going around. You know those street interviewers, right? Yeah. He was in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And he was interviewing the general public. He was interviewing this one person, and he just asked him, like, what do you think of the state or the affairs of the country, right? And the person, he kind of went off on a different topic, but he said basically, you know, God Almighty is enough, right? God Almighty is everything, and you need to not look at others, rather look into yourself first, right? Fix yourself. Because if you pray to Allah the Almighty, you know, you cry in front of him, you bow down in front of him and just submit yourself, he said, Allah the Almighty will give you the world.
Yeah, we'll fix
it. He will literally lay the entire world in front of you, fix all your problems. But the main problem is that we do not fix ourselves, and we go out pointing other people's mistakes, saying this politician is this, this person is that. Of course, you know, this is happening in the world, but you have been put in the situation which is best for you by Allah the Almighty. Or maybe you are in a trial basis, you know, a trial is happening with you, you're in tribulations, going through certain tribulations, but this is the situation which Allah the Almighty has deemed best for you. And if you wish that, you know, your state be changed, then cry in front of Allah the Almighty and turn to him, because you have lost your way.
Yeah, exactly. He's 100% right, because, you know, if we chase the world,
exactly,
we will not find the world.
Exactly.
But if we chase God Almighty, we will be able to get God Almighty.
Yes.
And he will give us the world with that.
Definitely. This is in accordance with the teachings of Islam.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do believe that we do have our first guest on the line with us, Dr. Jake Scott, who is the secretary of the Institute. He is an Anglican Christian and specializes in popular identity formation, having completed his PhD at the University of Birmingham. Good morning, peace be upon you, and welcome to The Breakfast Show.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Just for you know, the benefit of our listeners out there, could you briefly explain to our listeners what is the aim of the Institute and the aim of life is?
Absolutely. So the Institute for the Impact of Faith and Life was launched in October of last year, largely in response to the 2021 census results that showed that Britain was becoming increasingly a-religious. in the sense that nearly 50% of the population did not identify with a particular religion, which presented a really interesting historical circumstance in which you have nearly comparable elements of the population believing in God and not believing in God. But at the same time, Britain is becoming a increasingly heterogeneous religious society. We have a greater diversity of religions than at any time in our history, and these religions, these smaller religions such as Islam, are growing at a faster rate than previously. So there's an urgency to understand the role that faith plays in life, both at home, at work, and in the community and in public life in general. So the purpose of the Institute is to examine this, but also to address myths and misunderstandings surrounding faith and faith communities in the United Kingdom, and hopefully raise the public conversation to a more educated level.
Yes, definitely. And how has your research, you know, regarding the social contribution of British Muslims, how has that been conducted?
So we commissioned a nationally representative sample of 1,000 British Muslims at the beginning of February, and a comparable survey of the general population, again of 1,000 people at the same time. So the survey on 1,000 British Muslims focused on about 10 questions, looking at British Muslims' attitudes to different elements of society, you know, raising children, getting married, but also looking at the opinions of British Muslims on living in Britain and how far Britain was a good place to live as a Muslim whilst practicing the faith. And also being engaged in public life. And in comparison, the questions we asked of the general population were only 4 of the questions we asked of British Muslims, focusing again on attitudes to different aspects of life. At the same time, we also conducted interviews with different members of the British Muslim population from a diverse range of communities across the UK, and accompanied this with 10 case studies of successful and influential charities and organisations run by Muslims across the United Kingdom.
Okay, that's very interesting. Could you please go through some of the findings of your research?
Absolutely. I think some of the really headline statistics came over the fact that British Muslims are very optimistic about living in Britain. So, for example, 86% of British Muslim respondents said that Britain is a good place to live when it comes to people having the opportunities to progress and thrive in life. Yes. Which is actually higher than the general population, only 70%. So we're talking a significant difference of about 16%. And likewise, more than 4 in 5, so 83% specifically, said that compared to other European nations, Britain is a better place for Muslims to practice their faith and live their faith whilst being involved in public life, which was in line with our hypothesis that Britain is actually a very tolerant and very welcoming nation compared to some other European nations. But also, I think the important part of the findings was that most British Muslims, as much as 71%, said that more needs to be done in terms of building relationships and improving relationships between Britain's different faith communities. Yes. So overall, the picture presented of British Muslims goes counter to the narrative of a set of insular communities that don't want to engage in life in Britain. And actually, British Muslims are very optimistic about living in Britain, very grateful for the opportunities here, but want to be understood and want to understand other communities at a greater level than previously thought.
That's an interesting thing. Do you think this could be linked to the fact that, you know, a lot of British Muslims are either, you know, migrants themselves or children of migrants who have come for a better quality of life to this country?
Absolutely. What was really interesting with the demographics of the study was only 40% of our respondents were actually born in Britain. So the vast majority, when talking representatively, of British Muslims are born outside of the UK. Yeah. And obviously we discussed this at our panel when we launched the event on the 5th of October, and we, sorry, 5th of March. We of course had Mr. Safir Zartash Khan from the Voice of Islam station himself. And he's speaking as someone who came from Norway, was very much of the opinion that Britain has a greater infrastructure of laws that build respect and facilitate communication and dialogue between different communities.
Yes, definitely.
And do you think any... you know, all the views that you got from the Muslims, do you think freedom of religion plays a part in that?
Definitely. So, as I say, we discussed this at our panel on the 5th of March. We were joined by, of course, Dr. Reki Bassan, who's the other co-author of the report with myself, Abdurrahman Syed from Al Manar, the Muslim Cultural Heritage Centre, Salma Khanum from Aisha Help, and Tasneem Bindawala from the Dawi Deborah community in London, and of course, Safir. And all respondents talked about the real sense of religious freedom and religious tolerance and the ability to again, you know, practice the Muslim way of life whilst being integrated into British society. Mm. And this is something that we in Britain need to be more proud of and be more prepared to champion as a British success story. You know, the fact that we have a religiously tolerant community nationally that is prepared to accommodate whilst not forcing assimilation.
Yeah. And you know, in fact, you know, the Promised Messiah, the founder of our community, has praised the British government a lot regarding the religious freedom that it provides for its citizens.
Oh, that is wonderful to hear. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that's why I thought I'd ask you if the Muslims that you interviewed had any say regarding religion, freedom of religion.
Yeah, so when we talked to the... we had 28 interviews that formed the basis of the report, and religious freedom was one of the most consistent responses in terms of both thematic and coding responses to the questions. So usually over variations such as religious tolerance, religious freedom. One thing, again, at the panel that Salma Khanum, so Salma took part in the interviews, and she brought this up in the panel as well, said about how you can walk into most places in the UK, most towns in the UK, and you can buy halal food. Yeah. And you can go into most big cities in the UK, in fact, most large towns in the UK, and you can find a mosque not far from a synagogue and not far from a church and so on. And there is this broad and perhaps sort of benign acceptance of you know, religion's place in society. But what we want to do really at the Institute is take that from a sort of benign acceptance to a positive realization that actually faith plays a positive role in life.
Yeah. And did any of your findings resort to the multicultural aspect of Britain? Because, you know, it's a very multicultural society with different backgrounds, different faiths. Did any of them say anything regarding this?
Again, that was very much a common denominator. So we found that more often than not, it was Muslims living in places like London that commented on the multiculturalism of Britain, saying, of course, that, you know, it's a positive thing. It allows for greater integration to life without requiring assimilation, which is a very important difference and distinction. But yeah, almost all British Muslims that in the interviews that I spoke to talked about how the multicultural reality of Britain is a good thing and allows them to live their lives as they see fit. But also when you go to smaller towns in the UK, there isn't this negativity, there isn't this prejudice. It's a willingness to learn and to speak to British Muslims and understand rather than exhibit prejudice. So the multicultural reality of Britain is definitely praised amongst British Muslims.
Definitely. And why would you say that, you know, this research that you guys are conducting crucial in this day and age, and how can the society use this finding for their benefit?
I think one thing that we're trying to do over the next 12 months is focus on Islam specifically. And the reason for that is that it's the fastest growing faith in the UK,
yes,
but it's also the most misunderstood and misrepresented.
Yes.
So there was a study from the University of Birmingham, which I wasn't associated with, but came out about a year ago, that showed that British Muslims are prejudiced more than any other faith group in the UK. And usually that's around misunderstandings over the Quran,
yes,
or specifically the literality of the Quran. You know, there's,
yes,
a lot of people that think the Quran is taken literally,
yes,
whereas there's a lot of whereas you don't find comparable figures of people thinking the Bible is taken literally.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
But likewise, the Muslim Council of Britain has been careful in monitoring headlines around Islam in the UK and shown that the vast majority of headlines around Muslims in the UK are negative. You know, roughly 70% of media headlines are negative. So the purpose really of this report is to champion the role that British Muslims play in life, and talk about the positivity that they bring to the British social fabric, but also to dispel the myths surrounding British Islam, that it's not insular, it's not alien, it's very much accommodating and welcome.
Definitely, definitely.
But you know, all these positive effects that you just mentioned, that you would want out of this examination, do you think it's playing a role? It's having a positive impact on the society?
I'd love to think so. I'd certainly like to say so, that we that people are hopefully paying attention to the results of our research, and we'll be doing our best to spread that results as far and wide as possible.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Jake Scott. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. You know, you've shed really interesting light upon this topic. And for now, have a good morning and take care.
Thank you very much for having me. Take care.
Bye-bye. Peace be upon you. So that was a really interesting interview, right, with Dr. Jake Scott and the study that they have conducted, right?
Yeah. Really interesting.
It shows us that it can show the general public as well that
the positive sides
of religion in general, right? That it plays a good role in your life, and it benefits the society.
Exactly. Because if you have that faith, then you know positivity comes.
If you believe
in
a higher power,
exactly,
right, then you will be good to mankind, basically.
Exactly. Because religion teaches you the moral aspect of life.
Yes.
Teaches you how to live.
Definitely.
And it teaches you to be grateful, isn't it? So definitely. if a society is giving you that freedom of religion, then definitely you should be grateful for it.
Most definitely. We do have our next guest on the line with us, who is also a member of the Voice of Islam, Mr. Safir Zardasht Khan, who is an imam from the MD Muslim community of Gillingham, Kent. He also serves as the head producer of Drive Time Show in the Voice of Islam Radio. Assalamu alaikum, good morning, peace be upon you, and welcome to the Breakfast Show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, brothers, how are you?
Alhamdulillah, by the grace of Allah, we are doing very well. So just to get into things straight away, you had attended this lively discussion as well, you know, with the representatives from the Muslim communities by sharing your experience as a Muslim residing in the UK. What are your takeaways from the gathering?
Right, I was just listening to Dr. Jake Scott earlier, and he's the one who conducted a few interviews, I think, when the report came out. And then I was informed that I should join the panel. So I was fortunate to be able to be part of the panel when the report was released. And this event took place on 5th of March this year in a location near Westminster. And various journalists and academia were invited for the release of the report. So the report was then released and presented by Dr. Rakib. And after that, we had a panel discussion and question and answer led by Dr. Jake Scott. And most of the questions, obviously, was around the report, around the statistics. And the panelists gave the answers according to, obviously, their experience as working in their Muslim communities. And, you know, the standout, obviously, finding was that most British Muslims, 86%, feel that, you know, Britain is a good place to live in. They have good opportunities, they have progress, and they have religious freedom, they have a great environment to thrive in, to do good in. And also, more than 50% felt that they had a strong sense of, you know, belonging in the local community. And if you compare all of these numbers to non-Muslims, you will see that there is a big difference. So again, what it showed was that faith plays such a strong role for Muslims in terms of their daily life routine. So lots of people obviously may have come from different countries where they did not have those opportunities, they did not have a better environment to pursue their goals or dreams. But here, by the grace of God, you know, this is something that we always have to be thankful to God for, that we do have religious freedom, you know, here. We have challenges. I mean, Islamophobia is there as well, and it's increasing, there's no doubt. But overall, Britain is a great place to live, and one has to, you know, take that opportunity and be grateful to God for that, and you have to give credit to the government and to the system that is in place here, that, you know, if you compare that to many other places in the world where you don't have religious freedom, where you don't have the same opportunities, compare that to here, and you know, one is very lucky. And as a Muslim, yes, you are taught to be grateful and to make the best of the opportunities that God gives you.
Definitely. Could you briefly touch upon some of the social contributions that British Muslims have on Britain?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is clear for us, and I think this is something that is really important to talk about, because generally in the media, generally in the you know, in our society, negative news tend to get more coverage. Yes. And people you know, often, you know, say that, you know, Islam, Muslims are causing trouble, or, you know, they're not integrated enough, and, you know, there's so much negativity around you know, immigrants and Muslims in particular, because of what is happening in, for example, Middle East or in other parts of the world. However, the reality is quite the opposite. In fact, you know, Muslims who have been coming to the UK, to Britain, for many, many years, they have brought in a lot of wealth of cultural traditions. They have contributed to the economy. They have done jobs that that people here didn't have the manpower to do. Yes. And you know, apart from that, you know, they have also contributed to a richer society, a diverse society. Obviously, you know, diversity is something, again, that is needed in order to better understand. We live in a global world where you need to work and understand and cooperate with people from different parts of the world, and that's how business works. So British Muslims are very much a part of that.
Yes.
And many British Muslims who have come here, as I said, you know, the report told us that they feel that they have a great opportunity. So they, you know, go into really difficult careers. British Muslims, kind of, you can say, we have kind of a little bit of pressure.
Yes.
from our parents that we have to do good in our studies, right?
Yes.
We have to become entrepreneurs, you have to become doctors, lawyers, engineers, teachers, scientists. We have to do well. And so that positive pressure,
yes,
it results in a lot of British Muslims, you know, becoming professionals in very highly respectable fields. And
definitely,
you see that now, that as a result of that generation, you have so many British Muslims as doctors, as lawyers, etc., etc.
Yes.
So this is just one aspect of it. Then you obviously have the charitable work, the community work that Muslim communities do. Just look at the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. Just
yes,
recently we had, you know, the Ahmadiyya Annual Peace Symposium,
yes,
which was so important. And His Holiness has talked about how we can establish justice in the world, how we can work together as communities, how we can help each other as people of society, regardless of background, religion. So these kind of works, and this is not just once a year, but the communities, including the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, does these charity work, community work throughout the year, right? I mean,
yes,
in the different chapters, whether it's food banks, whether it's volunteering for good causes, whether it's disaster relief, whether it's helping, you know, visiting elderly homes, things like that. So
yes,
I can go on and on about it, but this
of
is
course
some of the, you know, positive contributions that Muslims have had to UK.
So what is the driving factor of, you know, Muslims acting, British Muslims acting the way that they do in society? What drives them to do this?
Yeah, I think what drives them to do that is faith, because there is a strong relationship. And throughout the report, when you read it, you will see that there is a strong difference in people who are not Muslims,
yes,
and people who are Muslims. There's a big percentage difference. For example, if you take the aspect of charity,
yes,
again, you know, why do you need to give to charity? People generally might believe, I mean, I'm not saying everyone, but there's a general concept, isn't it, that you try to earn as much money and think about yourself before you think about other people. But in Islam, is the opposite. Islam says that, you know, yes, you should keep something for yourself, but you should also give to those who are less fortunate, because a part of your wealth is deserving for those people.
Yes.
It's you know, that's what zakat is about, right?
Yes.
And this is what sadaqah is about as well. So in Islam, in the Islamic faith, there are countless of verses of the Holy Quran, there are countless of ahadith, sayings of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, where he has encouraged Muslims that you should give to charity, you should help people, those in need, and especially now that obviously we're going through the month of Ramadan, this is again a very important aspect of Ramadan, that along with fasting, we're supposed to be quite active giving in charity as well.
Yes.
Because wealth is something that we get by the grace of God. You know, Allah the Almighty gives us that. How? Because He has given us the capabilities, the mental capacity to earn wealth.
Yes.
And so as a thank to Allah the Almighty, we give some part of that to charity to help those people who are not as fortunate as we are, who in fact probably did not have the same opportunities that we had.
Yes.
So as Muslims, this is the way to clean your wealth. This is the way to purify your wealth. And this is exactly what zakat is as well, that,
yes,
you know, during the whole year, a percentage of your wealth you give in zakat, in obligatory charity,
yes,
that that purifies your wealth. So the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, did this all the time, and he really kept something for himself. If he had some food, he would give that to a person who would come to his door asking for it, yes, and he would fast himself. So that was his example. So these kind of teachings inspires Muslims to give more and more in charity. And in fact, if you look at the statistics as well, in UK, for example, Muslims on individual basis contribute the highest of all other groups in charity.
Yes.
So this, I think, it cannot be anything else but an inspiration from faith, and that's what I think is the, you know, deciding factor when
definitely,
you look at these statistics.
As if like, you know, it's like a code of life, you know, faith, that we, it's laid out for us what we need to follow and what we need to do.
Absolutely.
Just before we let you go, could you tell us about how we as a society can live peacefully despite each other's differences, and how we can ensure that it is a long-lasting?
Yeah, so I think this is a great question, and a question that we kind of need in this day and age where we see hatred and conflicts increasing around the world. And I think the answer again is in the Islamic teaching, and that is that we have to work towards peace. And how do we establish peace? We establish peace through exercising justice in the society.
Yes.
There are two aspects what Islam focuses on, and that is that if you want to establish peace in society, then you have to observe justice. But how can you observe justice if you do not fear justice yourself, right?
Yes.
So if you are a believing man or woman, you would know that whatever you do in this world, whatever actions you do, God will hold you accountable.
Yes.
So the one aspect of religion is to bring us closer to God Almighty. If we are more righteous, if we are more cautious, if we are more kind and, you know, spiritually better ourselves, then we will also make people around us better, and we may live our life in such a way that we always think about accountability, hence we will do the right thing. And second part of obviously Islamic teaching is the relationship and the rights that we have with people around us. So that is you know, serving mankind, helping people around us, and that together, if people focus on that and exercise justice and fairness in society on individual level, on society level, or international level, then we will see that the world will, be a much better place to live. But right now, the problem is that justice is not exercised. People always think about what is best for me,
yes.
And countries think what is best for our interests. We don't care what happens to other people as long as we benefit. So if you have that kind of mentality, then there will not be peace. And this is what the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is trying to do as well, to bring people back towards God Almighty,
yes.
And then also to bring people together and encourage them to do act with justice and kindness with each other, because that is essentially what the Islamic teachings are all about. And His Holiness has mentioned this over many, many years on peace conferences, that these are the solutions, the principles that we find in the Islamic teachings are the solution to world peace. So we hope and pray that people, follow those principles, even if people don't become Muslims, but
yes.
At least we need to follow the principles of justice in order to establish peace in our world.
Definitely, definitely. Thank you so much for joining us. Peace be upon you and take care. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
That was a really, enlightening interview with Imam Safid Zardosh Khan. And we are coming to conclude before the 8 o'clock news. We will be taking a very short break, and don't go anywhere. And then do join us. We will be carrying on discussing this topic and interviewing another guest. And then we'll be moving on to swiftly into our next segment and discussing the Gaza and Israel conflict.
God knows the little nuances of you, the little things that like only you would know, that you think about secretly. You don't tell anybody else, just between you and him.
Before I accepted Islam, before I learned about Islam, I was worried about it. I thought it was something to be worried about.
The more and more I kept thinking about what religion should I choose, what belief should I have, a dominating thought came into my mind, is that choose the one that describes God the best.
After learning about Islam and learning that the misconceptions are just that, misconceptions, I learned that it's something to embrace and it's not something to be afraid of, and it's a guide for you.
I believe that God paved a path that I could not veer from, that led me straight to Mirza Ghulam Ahmad alayhi salam.
The thing that's going to capture, that captured my heart, is the living God. Nobody else has this. You can go do good anywhere. You can be persecuted in a lot of groups, right? But you can't get that living God. That is ours for this age.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most gracious, ever merciful, peace and blessings of Allah be upon you. Welcome back to The Breakfast Show. We have been discussing the social contribution British Muslim. And, it's a really interesting topic that we do have at hand. There was a study conducted in regards to how the British Muslims do contribute very well to society and how they have integrated and how they believe that Britain is a land of opportunity.
Right? And it's all because of their faith, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all because of their faith, all the teachings that they've received from Islam that has contributed to their liking of Britain, because they have the opportunity. As you just mentioned,
yes.
As you also spoke to the guests earlier on, and that's what they were mentioning.
Yes.
That 86% of the Muslims that they did interview,
yes,
they had positive feedback.
Definitely.
And that they enjoyed living in Britain because
yes.
they had the opportunities that they don't have elsewhere.
Exactly. So
even in Europe,
yes,
they don't have the opportunity in some European countries that they have in Britain.
Mm.
So the feedback which they received was very good.
Yes.
And we also heard from our guests how they contribute to society because
yes.
of the teachings of charity and zakat and what the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, has shown us
yes.
from his role model, because
yes.
he's the best role
of
model
course,
for us.
Of course.
And him giving charity to the needy, to the poor, is one of the ways where British Muslims are able to contribute to society.
Yes.
And they're the leading.
You know some of the people, yes, do you continue?
Yeah,
do
and they, and they're yes. leading. They yes. lead. They're leading.
Leading by example.
By example.
Definitely.
More than any other religious
yes.
faith.
And I was referring, when I was speaking about that interview that was happening in Pakistan, of the random street interview, some of the points that the person made was that also that, Allah Almighty might ask you, did you go and ask your neighbor whether they had a full meal or if they were struggling or if they needed any help. You didn't. Allah the Almighty will ask you these questions.
That's a narration of the Holy Prophet, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. So you need to look after thy neighbor as well, and which is the teachings of not only Christianity, but also of Islam as well.
We do have our next guest with us. He goes by the name of Mr. Abdulrahman Sayyid, who is the CEO of the Muslim Cultural Heritage Center for the last 7 years. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show, Mr. Abdulrahman Sayyid.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For the benefit of our listeners, if you could please explain briefly regarding the Muslim culture heritage for us.
It is a community center which was established in the late 1990s, and it provides services, cultural, spiritual, and social activities to the local community in North Kensington and West London.
Yeah. And could you also share what is currently hindering, you know, mutual understanding between different communities within our society?
I think it's, I'm not really sure if there is really an absence of mutual understanding. Mm-hmm. There are obviously hindrances sometimes to community cohesion from time to time. Whenever there are cultural, social, and other differences, lack of understanding, lack of knowledge, lack also of communication and engagement can create misunderstanding between different communities. However, we are lucky that the United Kingdom is very much an open society that has been across the world, and the world also have been here in the UK. If you take London, for example, it's an international city where you can find people from across the globe, and therefore there is a good understanding of diversity, and also the system has been very much based on multiculturalism and recognition of differences and tolerance. However, from time to time, misunderstandings take place from all sides for various reasons, and these are quite natural, I think, and people do address them from time to time as well as they come on.
Mm. And, you know, we also asked our other guests how Muslims contribute to society. What would you say, in your view, the way Muslims contribute to our society?
I think the Muslim contribution is very visible socially, by enriching the cultural and other aspects of life within communities in different localities. Economically, there has been a market contribution of Muslims, and there's also the very important trading relationship of the United Kingdom with the Muslim world, which is not new. It's been going on through centuries. And then the charity-wise, also, it's been recognized and it's been declared by different prime ministers in the last few years, for example, that Muslims make a huge contribution every year, over £100 million for charitable purposes. Mm-hmm. So these are the positive contributions Muslims make to local economy and cultural and social enrichments. This, I think, can also be seen across the board, including in our health service. The other day, I was visiting one of the local hospitals in West London, and I found there a group of Muslim doctors treating patients and doing their daily job while fasting and practicing their faith. So you can see the Muslim contribution in every sector of the economy and of the society.
Yeah, and you know, as you mentioned, £100 million of charity. Is that within the year?
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
What would you say is the factor for this? Is it faith? Is it something else?
Yes. Yes, of course. The faith itself is based on encouraging charitable activities, making sure, starting from the nearest relatives and neighbors to the farthest. In fact, if you go these days, which is the fasting month of Ramadan, almost I can say all Muslim centers and mosques donate to you know, not just local issues but also to disasters or humanitarian crisis in faraway places, from earthquakes to floods to man-made disasters and wars, and Muslim charities are always fundraising from the Muslim communities in the UK to support those in need abroad. And that's obviously very much motivated and encouraged by the faith, and also by the society we live in. This is not exclusively a Muslim issue. Charitable work has been a tradition within the society, and I can particularly talk about this with confidence. When the Grenfell Tower was in fire in 2017, the people who came to the Muslim Cultural Heritage Center were from across communities, Muslims, non-Muslims, people of faith and no faith. They all came together, and sometimes even from faraway places like Manchester and other cities, with their donations to support the survivors from the fire. So I think their faith, as well as the societal and the entire environment, are very conducive and very encouraging to do charitable work. So I think that's the what encourages people to contribute.
Yeah. What, in your view, what would you say how we can foster this mutual understanding and peace across all communities?
I think engagement is very much important, engagement at every level, and understanding is a mutual concern. It's not just for one to be understood by the other, but for both sides to be understood by each other. I think that's very important. So constructive engagement through our institutions, community, faith, religious, whatever institutions that we have, we should be able to encourage constructive engagement between our different communities. Also, individually, we should be very much part of the civic society and civic democracy that we live in, or we chose to live in, and make positive contributions. As I said, Muslims now are engaged in different aspects. We have local governors or local councillors, as well as people, members of parliament, and so on. I think this is something that we can always encourage and promote. The other issues are whenever there is a case for you know, any misunderstanding, then also to come up with you know, proper, clear explanation, so the understanding can be there. So I would summarize that engagement is very much you know, the best way of promoting understanding.
And as you said, engaging is one of the best ways of promoting peace. Is there any other ways you think we can tackle the issue we are facing in this society?
The issues we face are always diverse, and they can change from time to time. But always, if you're engaged, you can work along, you know, you know, the route of addressing them. The other issue, which can also be related to engagement, is really to reach out, to promote commonalities, to promote shared values. So sometimes it's not, there are so many issues that can be addressed by working with others who have similar concerns from different faiths and no faith. For example, homelessness is an issue that affects everyone. The churches have been doing a great job in this area. Synagogues, gurdwaras, and others also have a great experience of supporting people in homelessness situations. So Muslims can come forward and work with those institutions, community institutions, faith institutions, to address problems that is of equal importance and concern to everyone. So identifying common issues is very important. That would encourage engagement and partnership work, and so on. So it's always important, I think, to not just wait, but to take proactive action and steps that helps address issues of common concern. And again, when there are any misunderstandings, this kind of working relationships could always help address them easier than if there wasn't any kind of like engagement or partnership or any kind of networking with other communities.
Yeah. That's very nicely put. You've provided a lot of very beneficial information for all of our listeners. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Abdulrahman Saeed, and have a lovely day. Peace be upon you.
Peace be upon you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. That was the CEO of the Muslim Cultural Heritage Center, and he's been the CEO for the last 7 years. He explained very well how we can achieve, you know, the understanding between communities and how Muslims are contributing to society. Yes. As well with our previous guest who explained how we can benefit and how we can improve our societies.
We do have a very brief audio clip of His Holiness from the Peace Symposium, which was held in 2010. Let's listen to that one.
The world has come together and the measures of distances have changed. And in every country, people of different religions live side by side. Therefore, it is necessary, and it is the need of the time, that within our cosmopolitan societies, the bond of love and affection should be strengthened. Respect and honor for one another should be inculcated. Allegiance to one's country should be infused amongst the entire society, and most importantly, the love of God be instilled into the hearts of the people. If these things are fostered, then they will guarantee harmony within each country, and individual restlessness will be replaced by peace.
So that was His Holiness, Hazrat Mirza Masroor Ahmad, may Allah peace help for the current head of the MTM Muslim community, you know, reiterating why it is so important to have peace in the world. And just like to briefly end this topic with the saying of the promised Messiah, peace be upon him, who said that do not attack anyone in any appropriate way and keep check on your passions. If anyone deals with you in a barbaric manner, say salam, meaning peace, and walk away from such a gathering. It should be that your hearts should be clear of deceit, your hands free of cruelty, and your eyes kept apart from ill impurities. And apart from honesty and kindness to the creation, there should be nothing else within you. So dear listener, we do hope that you've been enjoying today's show so far. If you do have any questions, you can call us in at 0286 877 8788, or if you want to give any feedback, and you can tweet us at the Voice of Islam UK also. For now, we'll be taking a very short break and then moving on to our second segment of the morning, so don't go anywhere and do join us after a very short break.
There is an account narrated about Sayyid Abdul Qadir Jilani, may Allah have mercy on him, that when he set out away from home for the purpose of his education, his noble mother sewed his share of 80 coins into the underarm of his shirt and advised him, "Son, do not lie." When Sayyid Abdul Qadir departed, on the first day of his journey, he passed through a jungle that was inhabited by a large band of thieves and robbers. A party of robbers confronted and apprehended him. The robbers asked, "What have you got in your possession?" Sayyid Abdul Qadir thought to himself that he was being tested in the first stage of his journey. He reflected over his mother's advice and said, "I have 80 coins which my noble mother has sewn into the underarm of my shirt." The robbers were extremely surprised on hearing this and said, "What is this dervish saying? We have never seen such a righteous man." They took him and, putting him before their chief, related the entire story. When the chief questioned him, Syed Abdul Qadir Jilani gave the same response. Finally, when his shirt was torn at the place that he had described, it turned out that there were indeed 80 coins sewn into his shirt. All the robbers were astonished, and the chief asked why Syed Abdul Qadir Jilani had told them the truth. At this, Syed Abdul Qadir Jilani mentioned the advice that his mother had given him before he departed. He said, "I have set out as a student of religion. If I had told a lie at the very first stage of my journey, what could I expect to attain? And so, I chose to stand by the truth." When Syed Abdul Qadir had said these words, the chief burst into tears, fell at his feet, and repented for his sins. It is said that this chief was the first follower of Syed Abdul Qadir Jilani. In short, truth is a thing that delivers a person in even the most trying and difficult of times. Saadi is true when he says, "Never have I seen go astray the one who treads the right path." Therefore, the more a person adopts the truth and develops a love for the truth, the deeper a love and understanding they develop for the word of God and also for his prophets, because they are an example and source for all those who are truthful. This principle is also prevalent in the following instruction: be with the truthful.
Well, dear listener, welcome back to the show. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon all of you, as we will now be swiftly moving on to our second segment of the show, which is, as we previously said, Israeli human rights groups accuse country of failing to abide by ICJ's Gaza aid ruling. As the matter is going on, the war of Israel and Palestine is still going on after 4 or 5 months now. So the gist is that 12 of Israel's most prominent human rights organizations have signed an open letter accusing the country of failing to comply with the International Court of Justice, which is ICJ, provisional ruling that it should facilitate access of humanitarian aid into Gaza. So now, you know, Israel's most prominent human rights organizations, so their country's own members have now started to stand up and say that they are not complying with the International Court of Justice. This conflict, in fact, did not start, as everyone might think, started on the October 7th, but it was triggered when Hamas carried out an attack on October 7th. However, this conflict began when the State of Israel was created, which caused many Palestinians to be forced out of their homes. So this it did not start on October 7th, as some people might think. It started much before that. Now, you know, Hamas is a terrorist group. It attacked Israel in October, injuring and killing many Israelis, as well as taking hostages. That's what Israel claims, that that's what they did. And they committed a lot of atrocities and killed around 1,200 innocent civilians. But later on, as we all know, according to the news, it was falsely proven that it wasn't 1,200 people, but rather it was much less than that. We do have our first caller for the segment on the show, who is Cecilia Elworthy. Welcome to the show, Cecilia. Hopefully I'm pronouncing your name properly.
Yes, that's quite fine.
To begin with, please, could you tell our listeners about the business plan for peace, as you're also a 3-time Nobel Prize, Peace Prize nominee?
Well, a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago, I investigated the forces that drive armed conflict and war. And I also investigated what's already working to prevent war and what it would cost to scale up what works to prevent war. And so the first time we could estimate what a costed business plan for peace would look like. And the answer was, at the end of this book that I wrote, that war can be prevented for about $2 billion a year, which is nothing compared to what we spend on war at the moment. So that's just the reason why we set up the business plan for peace in 2018. And it's now flourishing with members all over the world and a great deal of research, particularly into the role of women in the prevention of armed conflict.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say, what is the role of women in the prevention of armed conflict?
Well, women have a lot of skills that are not currently being used to prevent armed conflict. Mm-hmm. Women use intuition to enable the warring parties to actually understand what's needed at the moment. And they come up with ideas and possibilities that could actually, what they call, enlarge the pie, which men in power might not dream of. Also, the male need for revenge is often triggered by shame, feelings of humiliation, and including their failure, as they feel it, to protect the women they love. And revenge seems like the only way to alleviate these feelings and restore their sense of pride. But women can take a longer-term view, enabling leaders to think more creatively about what might support a longer-term peace. So if you get a balance of women in negotiating teams, that has been shown to help reach a peace deal that lasts longer. So they analyzed in the United Nations 182 signed peace agreements between 1989 and 2011. And where women were involved, these peace agreements are 35% more likely to last for 15 years, mm-hmm. which is much longer than most peace agreements. Mm. Also, women are very good at the secret back channels, crucial in resolving many conflicts. In such quiet conversations, the ability to speak truth to power without provoking hostility and violence can bring clarity and hope.
Mm. And what would you say the secret back channels are that you mentioned that women are quite good at?
Well, it's getting away from only the power brokers in a conflict. But if you talk even to the military on either side very quietly and find out what they would see as a way to reduce hostilities, to reduce crises in a war. That's one way. The other secret back channels are to mobilize very large numbers of those who are actually opposing the war and have reasons for doing so which are not necessarily political and who want the war to stop, and to let the voices of those people begin to be heard.
Mm-hmm. Regarding armed conflicts, what would you say are the first steps that can be taken in the resolution of armed conflict?
Well, the key one is to listen. And we're none of us very good at listening, but the skills that develop understanding require the ability to sit and listen to the other side until you understand what they want and what they're doing, clear enough to repeat it back to them in a way they accept, and then you change over. Mm. So if the leaders of the negotiating parties are able to do that, then although it's an extremely challenging process and it takes huge courage and patience, this stage of the process means that those powerful feelings, if they've been expressed, are less likely to keep feeding the vicious cycle. Then you can begin to get beyond the bottom lines. You know, we always start negotiations in war with this is my bottom line or this is our bottom line. And it's contentious, it's fractious, and it's provocative. But if we can handle that process with care, after some time the facilitators, the go-betweens, may be able to suggest possible advantages for either side. So they can be then taken back to the senior leaders and draw them into a further meeting. But all throughout this process, listening and letting each round of talks be guided by listening instead of interrupting, restating my position and so on, the skilled mediators will insist that not only the demands of each side are listened to, but their deeper needs. When we get to what their needs are, they're quite different often from their demands. And then the participants can feed back to their own side and then to their opponents what they've understood. And when that can be looked at and corrected, did you really say this? Do you mean that? Then, although tensions will arise, those skilled mediators can use actually compassion, compassionate communication, to defuse the tension.
But you know, recently UN has passed resolution for an immediate ceasefire.
Yes.
In Israel and Palestine conflict that's going on.
Yes.
What would you? And you said that we should sit down and listen to the reasoning and talk to each other, but what if the other side is not willing to listen? As they just passed the resolution, we see that the Israelis are still attacking the Palestinians with airstrikes, even though they've just passed the resolution. And they don't really, it looks like they don't really want to listen. So what would you do in that situation?
This conflict that's raging at the moment is one of the hardest ever I've seen to be resolved because of the absolute obstinacy of the Israeli government to listen, to understand, and to see where the interest is for them, let alone for the people besieged in Gaza. The interest for them in the eyes of the world now, the whole world is watching. And I doubt if Israel will ever be forgiven for what they're doing. But they are intransigent, they're driven by ideology and by a long militaristic response to the whole Middle East conflict. And it comes from their experience in the Holocaust. I mean, that has never been healed, but it's no excuse for doing what they're doing now.
As in, if someone has been through a calamity, a tragedy in their life, they would be expected to not rehearse that again, isn't it?
But not necessarily, because the pain that resides in a group of people, particularly a very large group of people, like the Israelis after the Holocaust, that pain is so deeply buried and so not forgotten, no efforts have been made really to come to terms and get beyond that terrible pain that they suffered. We're all aware of that. But it is time now that this fueling of another round, which will lead to, if it's not stopped now, it's going to lead to the most appalling rerunning of atrocities in the future.
Yeah, 100%. What do you see as the biggest obstacles when trying to come to like a lasting peace agreement during an armed conflict, as we're seeing in the Israel-Palestine conflict as well? As you know, it's a big obstacle for us to bring them together and have a peace agreement. What would you say is the biggest obstacle?
I think the biggest obstacle is doing these things in public. When the press is constantly watching a negotiation, it makes it very difficult for those who have it to answer to their constituency back home to really think broadly about how they could find ways to come to an agreement. So it's very, very late in the day now. And I feel that the only way to resolve what's happening now is to remove the supplies of arms to Israel.
Yeah. As in, you know, of course, if we are able to remove that, then they don't have any way of committing these atrocities. And, you know, the His Holiness, our current head of the community, has been saying to stop the arms to any country that has been committing these kind of acts to other nations for a very long time. And do you think this is the only way that can be, that we can stop this situation from escalating? Or is there any other way?
I think there are other ways, but let me first pay attention to the huge amounts of money made by the arms production companies when they see a war in the possibility in the future.
Yeah.
So the arms companies do bear a lot of the responsibility for rushing around the world, arming everybody they possibly can, and making an absolute fortune out of it for their shareholders and themselves. So that's the first thing to make it, unacceptable to have these massive arms companies selling weapons worldwide. But the other thing is to introduce women into the negotiating teams for the reasons I've tried to outline earlier. Because when women sit down at the table, when they are allowed to speak, what they voice is the agony of the children that are getting wounded, the destruction of homes and no food and so on. So when those issues that are so human and so devastating are brought to the table and brought for resolution, to even if right now you were able to stop the starvation that's going on in Gaza, that would be one step when to get food in, and for both sides to agree to do that and support each other to get to stop people starving. That would be one good step on the way.
And you know, in the IDF, the military of Israel, we have there are a lot of women that we see on social media. Do you think they're playing? What kind of role do you think they're playing?
I don't know any of them. And I know there are some everywhere. There's some very militant women in any country. Mm-hmm. There are very women who are, you know, devoted to militarism. I don't mean just soldiers, because there are a lot of very good female and male soldiers on both sides who are humanitarian and doing their best. But what has happened, I think, in Israel, and I'm not informed on the individual women, but what has happened, I think, in this crisis is that Netanyahu has allowed into his circle, his cabinet, if you like, the most militaristic, whether they're women or men.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thank you for joining us today, Dr. Cecilia. It was a pleasure speaking to you, and you've benefited a lot of our listeners today on the show. Peace be upon you.
Thank you, and peace be upon you too.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Dr. Cecilia Elworthy, who was a 3-times Nobel Peace Prize nominee for her work. And she did mention quite a lot of beneficial things. And how to stop the conflicts that are happening around
most
the world.
Most definitely. We do have a brief audio clip in regards to this topic as well. So let's listen to that one briefly.
This was prophesied in the Holy Quran that twice will the Israelites be turned out of Palestine and twice they will recapture it. And twice will they be tried. If they conducted themselves well in the sight of Allah, then they will not be punished. But if they reverted to the old follies, then they will be punished and turned out of Palestine, and Palestine would be inherited by godly people, by the righteous people. So, unless this prophecy is fulfilled in both manners. You know, there are two things mentioned in this prophecy. Number one, the Jews will recapture one day in the latter days. The word latter days is Wadul Akhira, is the word used, is the expression used in the Holy Quran. In the promise of the latter days, Jews will be made to return to Palestine. This is a prophecy of the Holy Quran. Nobody could alter it. After them, the land will be inherited by pious people. So if the Muslims of the time were already pious, why should they have come to Palestine at all? That means to say that at the time when the Jews would recapture or re-enter Palestine, generally speaking, the Muslims would have been rejected by Allah as not pious. In the meantime, a pious community would be created from among them. And Jews will ultimately be made to leave Palestine in shame and in defeat. And that land would be inherited, al-Ard, by the God-fearing people of Allah. Ibadus Salihun, that is, those who do good deeds and who are pious, virtuous people. So Ahmadiyyat came to prepare that group which would ultimately inherit that land. And this phenomena went parallel, side by side, for a while. On the one side, we observe the fulfillment of the Holy Quran in the way of Jews recapturing Palestine. On the other side, we see that community being prepared and being educated, which would ultimately, inshallah, enter Baitul Muqaddas and inherit it from Allah. So I don't see any contradiction in these two things. If you see any contradiction after my explanation, please clarify your question further.
So,
that I have already explained. The fact is that according to the Holy Quran, as well as according to the traditions of the Holy Prophet of Islam, a most unfortunate time was to come to Muslims when they were no longer to be Muslims in reality, in the sense that as a whole, they would be pious, God-loving, God-fearing people. They would stick to the word and spirit of the Holy Quran. If that prophecy is to be fulfilled, and we know it, not only is it to be fulfilled, it has been fulfilled, then such people have no longer a right to whatever they were given by Allah by way of favor. And the Holy Quran makes a very fundamental declaration in this regard. It says, "Inna Allaha la yughayyiru ma biqawmin hatta yughayyiru ma bi anfusihim." Whatever Allah has given to some people, He does not alter that state of favors until first people themselves change themselves and no longer deserve those favors. Then Allah takes away those favors. Sometimes a people are punished at the hands of worse people. And that is a phenomenon of punishment. That doesn't mean that Jews are dearer to Allah. It only means that the Muslims of this time are to be demonstrated by Allah that they are no longer on the right path. They are no longer God-fearing and righteous. So Allah's wrath is showing to them, and in a manner that which is also so insulting. To be punished by a person lower than you is a very great insult. It adds insult to injury. So to be punished in itself is bad. but to be punished at the hands of somebody who stands lower in status and degree is the worst punishment. Like that happened in the time of Tsar. You know, when the Tsar refused, now told his, one of his guards not to let anybody enter his palace because he was busy in some very important work, Tsar's son appeared and he tried to force his way to the palace. The guard stopped him and said, "No, it is the order of my master. I am not going to permit you to enter." He started beating him. And after that, when he got tired, he thought now he would have changed his mind. He tried again to enter the palace and he said, "No, the orders still remain. I am not going to permit you." Because he was a very strong, burly man, so this prince could not enter by force, but he kept on beating him until Tsar heard this noise. And when he came out, he knew what was happening, in fact, but he asked innocently, "What was the matter? Why is he beating you?" He said, "Look, it was..." he asked his son, "Why are you beating?" He said, "He did not permit me to enter the palace." He says, "Oh, that is his crime, that is his audacity. All right, but what did he say?" He said, "I am not permitted by my master, the king." He said, "You heard this and yet you insisted?" So he told the guard to take up the whip in his own hands and start beating this prince, the very son of the king. He took very strong exception to this. Not to the punishment, but to the punishment at the hand of a lowly placed person. The whole incident revolves this issue, this debate. He says he is lower than I am and he can't beat me, he has no right to beat me. So the king went on raising his status until he was raised to the status of a prince, and then he said, "Beat him now." So in the worldly affairs, we see the punishment is made more ignoble and more torturous when you are punished at the hands of a lowly person as compared to you. So sometimes this is how Allah's wrath comes. His displeasure appears. That people who are not closer to Allah than you are appointed to punish you for your running away from Allah and discarding His message. It has happened many a time in the history of Muslims. It's no wonder. At the time when Baghdad was being attacked by the herds, by the hordes, Khawanin hordes from Mongolia, the caliph of the time sent messengers to a very holy person who was living a retired life, and it was said that his prayers are accepted by Allah. So he sent, beseeched him to pray to Allah that Allah may avert this calamity, which was reaching Baghdad very rapidly. So the entire night he kept on praying. As he had told the king, the messenger of the king, to come in the morning to receive the answer, when he appeared in the morning, you know what his answer was? He said, "All night I have been praying to Allah to avert this calamity and to stop this horde of non-believers, and the entire night I have been given this revelation repeatedly. Ayyuhal kuffar, uqtulul fujjar. Ayyuhal kuffar, uqtulul fujjar. O non-believers, murder or kill the believers who are not righteous. Fujar are those who believe in God or in His messenger, but whose deeds are ugly and bad and corrupt." So this was the revelation made to him throughout in answer to his prayer. He said, "From this I understand that they are coming by way of Allah's decree and punishment. And now you have earned Allah's displeasure. Nobody can avert this calamity. This is going to befall you." So it has happened there too. So why can't it be repeated? And if the Muslims take the lesson, if they begin to see the message, then the things will, inshallah, be totally transformed in their favor and against the Jews. If they become Ibadiyas Salihun, as is said in the Holy Quran, Allah would see to it that they inherit the land again, and the Jews are turned out of that land.